the ICE facility and what's going on with people being detained at the ICE facility?
I don't really know what's going on in there, but I'm beginning to believe that what I'm hearing out here on the street, I'm beginning to believe that it is true. There's been a man who was too afraid to be on this side of the street because he was taken in. I don't know what day. All I know is that he ended up in the emergency room. He was kicked in the kidneys, broken ribs, and he wants to be here, but he's terrified of these people, the people behind the guards, the DHS, the whoever they are back there. They've all got mismatched uniforms. I saw a man with an assault rifle yesterday, strapped across him behind the gate. They all come out in mass formation. They come out into the street when the bus comes out. And I just now witnessed yet another car coming out of the ICE facility. No license plates, blacked out windows. And I see these cars coming and going all day long. My housekeeper is at her home, afraid to leave her house because her paperwork keeps being delayed. Her son has dropped out of high school to work at McDonald's to make enough money so they don't get evicted from their home. She's Hispanic. She's in our country legally.
She's here legally and still is fearful.
Yes, because they haven't given her an appointment to come down here. So she's afraid that they could literally pick her up off the street and bring her down here and detain her. And she's terrified. We're standing here. Here comes another blacked out windowed vehicle leaving the ICE facility. It's having to wait because of traffic, but it has blacked out windows. Can't tell if it has a license plate on it, but this is real. And Portland doesn't know. I live up in the West Hills. People don't know what's going on down here. And people are also terrified to drive by here because they think that some of these people on the sidewalk here where I'm standing are dangerous. Okay, this car actually does have an Oregon plate, but all blacked out windows. Okay, and a small van just pulled into the facility with all blacked out windows, a van.
All blacked out windows, yeah. I did see that.
But this is all day long. And Portland does...
There goes another car, yes, blacked out car.
Another blacked out car with a shield over its license plate. This is more activity right now than what I saw yesterday, the in and out. And, you know, we don't know. We don't know if there's a person in there or not, right? We can't see. I didn't believe any of the stuff till I saw it for myself. And I'm going to keep coming back.
You have been listening to Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineer, and thank you for listening.
Down by the river, where the rain runs cold, there's a frog in Portland, brave and bold. He don't carry signs. He don't throw stones, just hops on the line with a megaphone. They call him Big Frog, some say Setar. Just a man in green, facing ours. But when the gas rolls in, he don't run away. He just croaks out loud, not today. Ribbit, 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 let freedom sing. It's a funny old way to do your thing. With a smile and a hop, you can make your stand in a frog suit holding freedom's hand. With the chicken, the shark, and the unicorn parade, we all march proud in the Frog Brigade.
You're listening to KBOO Portland Community Radio. Yeah!
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Here in the city of Oakland, there's been a lot of talk about policies that are being suggested, actions that are being taken, and the plight of one of the largest homeless populations in the country. What we're talking about today pertains to other areas where you have large degrees of homelessness. And the reason why it pertains is because you're seeing ideological power struggles. You're seeing many folks who are in position of power riding a wave that suggests it's perfectly okay to disappear the homeless and to not only demonize, but criminalize them. We've seen this play out in the streets of D.C. where there were concerns that there were too many homeless folks, and the next thing you know, National Guard was sent in, ICE agents, and you don't see the tents anymore. The problem is nobody knows where those homeless folks have disappeared. And if we look at history, we know that once upon a time, homeless folks were rounded up and imprisoned or even killed. Will Oakland go in that direction? We hope not, but there are scary forces at play. And we have a couple of people who are knee-deep in facing on this problem. They're advocates and policy workers, and let me introduce them to you. One person who's no stranger to our airwaves is Nita B. You know her for her work as an advocate. She's the head of The Village, which is one of her organizations, and she's been blowing the whistle on some of the storm clouds that are brewing in City Hall. Another person who's been kicking up dust has a real, very unique and very strong inside perspective. He worked for Shang Tao. He worked for the former mayor or interim mayor, Kevin Jenkins. He's been a policy wonk, if you will, inside City Hall, and somebody who's been pointing out the fingers, or has been pointing fingers at the wrongdoers and some of the things that many of us would find to be corrupt. His name is Brandon Harami, and I want to welcome you all to the show. Let me start off with you, Nita, because I've run into you a lot, and you've been telling me it's not good times here. So let's start with, what is the lay of the land when it pertains to the homeless right now? What are we looking at?
Yes. Well, first, thanks for having us on today to talk about this very timely and urgent matter. The lay of the land, you know, we've talked about this before. There's been a wave of the desire to criminalize unhoused people and, like you said, make them disappear, happening across the country. And it's now here in Oakland. And again, these laws that have that are being implemented and enforced across the country are very similar in language and intent to the Jim Crow laws, where, you know, that were targeting in the South primarily black folks, and making everything black folks did criminal, of wanting to just punish and make black folks controlled and if not disappeared, incarcerated. And, you know, as it came across to this side of the country, it started targeting Mexicans and Japanese and Chinese folks, are who the Jim Crow laws of California targeted. But that's what we're seeing now with, you know, this latest target are the poor, the unhoused. And it's dangerous. It's very dangerous times because it's opening the doors. You know, if they start with the homeless, who are they going to go after next? And that was actually a slogan that, you know, came out of Nazi Germany. You know, people know that about what happened to the Jewish community, but the target of criminalizing and killing the Jewish folks didn't start with the Jewish folks. It actually started with the unhoused. That was the first group that got targeted by Hitler's regime. And then it moved on to the gypsies, or the Roma, as they call themselves. And then it targeted the Muslims. And then it targeted LGBTQ folks. And then it targeted anyone who was, dissenting Hitler. And then it targeted, this group and that group. The last group to get targeted that we know about are the Jewish folks. And we're seeing history not just repeat itself, but echo itself right now, with the target being immigrants and unhoused people are the current targets under the Trump regime. And what we see happening is making the existence of unhoused people criminal. And it's here in Oakland, like we said, with Ken Houston and the chief of staff of Kevin Jenkins coming full force with creating a proposal known as the encampment abatement policy that would redefine what an encampment is to exclude anyone who lives in a vehicle. It would target anyone living in vehicles. It would target anyone living on the sidewalks. And the reality is that leaves very few places. If you're most of the places that we see unhoused people living on are on sidewalks.
Before I bring in Brandon, let me ask you this, Nita, because when you talk about the civil rights movement and you talk about segregation, though the words that make people perk up, and folks who have gone through that sometimes become very defensive of that because they feel like a lot of movements and a lot of people attach themselves to that. I want to maybe put this in a little bit more perspective. And I'll start off by saying that when we're talking about the homeless here, I think the image is we think of somebody who's white, we think somebody who's a meth head, who looks disheveled, you know, the old Bowery from the Bum type of image is what pops up. We think of the folks that we've seen in Berkeley at Once Upon a Time at People's Park, who seem to be on drugs and out of their mind, and that becomes the image. But my experience has been, you know, even here by the lake where I'm at, almost all the homeless folks that I see are black folks, and they're older. Right. And that, to me, puts a little bit different twist, because now some of these policies are coming from other black folks. And, and the argument is often made that some of those folks will cloak themselves in language of the civil rights era, will talk about, you know, the pride of being a descendant of folks of that struggle. And yet some of the policies that are being embraced and some of the rhetoric that's being used seems to be deeply antithetical to that movement. But your take on this, when you say Jim Crow, can you maybe clarify that a little bit with respect to the homeless?
Well, the Jim Crow laws were, AKA the Black Codes in the South, were designated to basically criminalize everything that black folks did in an era where post-emancipation, post-slavery. So the white power structure could not deal with the fact that black folks could not be treated as slaves anymore. And so, as we know, the 13th Amendment didn't really end slavery. It just transformed it into the prison system. And so the attack came not so much to impose slavery again in a very straightforward way, but to legalize slavery if you were a criminal. And so they created these set of laws that made anyone who was labeled as black a criminal. And at that time, black folks, a majority of black folks did not own land. A majority of black folks who left the plantations were landless. They were impoverished. They were not getting hired for jobs. And so the Jim Crow laws targeted people who were being homeless, targeted people who were panhandling, targeted people who were cooking outdoors, targeted people who were using the bathroom outdoors, targeted people who were sleeping or camping outdoors. And if you take those laws and apply it to the unhoused people, they're identical. They're an identical set of laws that are criminalizing people for existing who have been pushed to the margins of society by structural, you know, in that case, it was structural racism. In this case, in 2025, in the millennium, it's structural racism and structural classism. And I think, you know, where you, like, you raise the point that a majority, like, there are people who are pushing these policies, these very cruel and inhumane policies, these questionable policies, who identify as Black. And that's why I think it's important to mention that this is not just structural racism happening, but structural classism that's happening. This is an attack on the poor. And it boggles my mind. I'm happy you raised that. It boggles my mind because that is like a myth that has been weaponized, that Oakland is being, all the homeless aren't from here. Like one of the most recent tirades that have happened on social media from Karen is when he basically supervised, for lack of a better word, a demolition and towing of an RV community in his district. And he talked about, all these are people from Oakland, I mean, from Oregon. But the folks who actually lived in those RVs were all Black folks, mostly Black senior citizen men who were from the neighborhood. But you didn't see them on the camera. What he did was targeted on the advocates. He targeted on the white advocates who were there, because there were also melanated advocates from that group. But he targeted the white folks who live here in Oakland. They happen to be white. And it's really strange how he understands how our communities are triggered by gentrification and the presence of white people in our communities, and what that means for us, and the kind of displacement and inequality that happens. And he fully exploited that trigger through his messaging. And I think, so he's weaponizing people's trauma through that. He's also, the proponents of this proposal are also weaponizing the idea of equity. One of their arguments in pushing this proposal is that a majority of homelessness, all the homelessness, is occurring in the flatlands and impacting Black legacy families and brown communities, and that is inequitable. For, this is literally what they're saying, it is inequitable for them to be having to carry the burden of having unhoused people in the flatlands, and therefore we need to get rid of unhoused residents, because Black and brown homeowners, Black and brown renters, are being inequitably impacted by their presence.
Appreciate that, Nita B. And I want to come back to that inequity point, but I want to bring in Brandon Harami. And Brandon, we mentioned that you worked for several administrations. You've been an insider. Yeah, I hate to use that word because it's so cliche. But you've seen where the bodies are buried, and you've seen how folks operate. From the perspective of somebody who's been inside City Hall and has been in these meetings when policies are being discussed, What do our listeners need to know about some of the things that have been mentioned, some of the things that are coming down the pipe, and how these policies and attitudes were developed?
Yeah, and I appreciate, I just want to say I appreciate what Nita had said about Jim Crow and emphasizing that this impacts Black folks. The actual encampment abatement apology acknowledges in Section A under equity considerations, it acknowledges that 53% of Oakland's unhoused population are Black. We know based on the point in time count, the Alameda County point in time count, that around 80% of our unhoused population lived in the East Bay before becoming homeless. had lived here for over 10 years before becoming homeless, and that we know that the next largest demographic in homelessness in Oakland is our Latine population. So about 54% Black, and then another 20% and change Latine. So you know, super majority of the people who are on our street who are homeless are people of color, Black or Latine specifically. And I just want to add too, what Nita had pointed out with Jim Crow and the 13th Amendment, a large portion of our single Black men, which is the most common person you'll run into, have come back, are re-entering society from the quote unquote justice system, the injustice system, and are struggling to find jobs and struggling to find housing because we don't have strong reentry programs. And yeah, most of them are head of the Department of Race and Equity made a point that the vast majority of homeless people living in Oakland now are from Oakland, and they try to remain within the zip code that they lived their whole lives because people want to stay within their community. And I think it's important to recognize that, yes, you do have a large Black homeless population in the flats. Well, if you go up to Montclair and so, you don't see that, right? And there, you know, there's a big question is, okay, why are the Black and brown folks becoming homeless while the white folks are doing fine? And we can look back at redlining, we can look back at, you know, lack of investment into Black communities and the schooling, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, there's gonna be plenty of space to talk about that. I think I wanna emphasize that this policy is something that Council President Jenkins absolutely 100% is behind and working on, not just as chief of staff. I find it very strange that he's trying to pawn this off on a staffer that reports to him, because I, when I was still in the mayor's office, I was in meetings between Houston Jenkins and his chief of staff around this issue.
Who are these people, Houston Jenkins, for our listeners?
Yeah. Council President Jenkins, I worked under him when he was interim mayor. So he had been interim mayor after the recall, and because he was council president, he ran the mayor's office and ran the district six office through his chief of staff at the same time. She ran the day-to-day operations, but he provided her direction. So and when we were in the mayor's office, Councilmember Houston is the district seven council member, the one introducing this encampment abatement policy. They had several meetings about the policy as early as March in the mayor's office, discussing how to get it passed, which council members to get on board, and these meetings, which led to a Brown Act notification, which essentially the Brown Act restricts council members from meeting in private, having a majority meet in private. So you can meet, if you're a council member, you're going to introduce legislation. In order to make sure that it's transparent and that you haven't secured a majority before going to council and kind of skipping the community process and just passing something, a council member is required to only be able to include three other council members. So just one council member short of a majority to have those private meetings. And then any other council members can only be made aware when the public is. And this is to make it so, you know, a council member can't meet with every single council member, get consensus, and then rush through policy. But Jenkins' office broke that law, it's a state law, Brown Act, by having his chief of staff go on his behalf to meet with all the council members. And and they seem surprised by this, that this was, you know, they're acting like, oh, we didn't know this. But I had a very straightforward conversation because I worked for the city council for 3 years. And I told Councilmember Jenkins, I'm like, isn't this a Brown Act violation to have your chief of staff meet with every council office because she represents you? He's like, no, it's fine. And then it turned out it wasn't. But it did to me worry me that they were going to try to rush something through in March when I first heard about this. And lo and behold, you were seeing this, that the council president is using his powers to schedule a meeting outside of the committee process. So what he can do is he can just be like, we're going to have a special meeting on this date, and I can call it whenever I want because I'm the council president. While the normal process the other process that's more inclusive and more transparent is to have these special meetings get scheduled through the rules committee. But he's been bypassing that and trying to rush meetings through very quickly. And that's probably because he doesn't want the pushback and the scrutiny. Not even probably, it definitely seems that way.
Well, we're also at a time now where the rules are being, you know, flaunted and ignored from the highest offices of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a number of folks, including people that live here, that seem to have no problem with that as long as the job gets done. Mm-hmm. We see that play out when we talk about police accountability, and you see folks that are like, well, you know, just let the police loose. They need to do some things, you know. If they've got to knock some heads to get things done, then let them do it. And so there's a tolerance for rule breaking, and that seems to follow that sort of trend. I don't know if it's a majority of people, but it's a sizable amount that mm-hmm. somebody who is sitting as a acting mayor or city council person will feel quite comfortable in doing that and feel that there's a community that will back them, you know, or at least a sizable. With that being said, what exactly would the policies do? How does this play out? If somebody, there's a guy that sleeps in his car every night by the library. I know that guy also gets up and works and comes home and sleeps. There's a lot of Uber drivers that sleep underneath the freeway here in their cars, right? Because they drive in from Modesto and other places. And then that's on top of folks who sleep in camps and people who are permanent residents in cars. And, you know, depending on, they might be moved from one part of the street, you know, one area, and they wind up being in another. So what would these policies do exactly?
Nita, do you want to take this, or do you want me to go for it?
You go for it first, and I'll come back to Nita.
Okay. I think that the biggest changes around the vehicle abatement place, which is basically right now the encampment management policy, which I was around when it was passed, and I'm going to be, this is how crazy things are being. Lauren Taylor did a more transparent process in getting that done than what is going on now. Like, Lauren Taylor is more transparent. I'm not going to say he's much better on the policy, but he was more transparent. So that's how far we've come. So the big issue in this policy itself is removing vehicles from the protections of the encampment policy. And what that means is, once vehicles are no longer recognized as shelter, they can be enforced through other mechanisms. So instead of, you know, going out and having to go through the 14-day policy where you go out and offer services and offer, you know, services that are adjacent to the needs of the residents, and this whole process that the city is supposed to do now, I'm saying supposed to do, but is supposed to do now and work with the county to do, that is not going to be required for vehicles anymore. It would be a simple, hey, your tags are expired, we're towing your car. Hey, your car has been parked here against, you know, the 72 hours. You're only allowed to park on the street. I don't know if you know that in Oakland, but in unmetered parking, you're only allowed to park on the street for 72 hours. So once that's over, the city could decide, oh, this, you know, RV that this person's living in, it's not protected under any encampment policy. We can tow it within 72 hours. So mm-hmm. that particular outreach and shelter offer and all that, that is not going to be necessary for vehicles. And our director of Department of Race and Equity made a very good point that, you know, you can remove people from their vehicles, but those people still have to go somewhere, right? And I think, Mr. Davey, we see this at, I live near the lake as well. If you walked around the lake right now, you would have, and someone told you, hey, the city closed the encampments at the lake last April. They didn't. I mean, they might have, but the encampments are still there, right? People still have to go somewhere. So closing these RV encampments or closing these encampments without offering anywhere to go is just shuffling the problem around. And it's going to spend a lot of, you know, for those who are more concerned with the fiscal health of the city and how many police officers, you know, they have, that's going to be resources that aren't going to be, I don't know why my hand raised. Oh, because I'm doing this. That's going to be resources that are not going to be available for, you know, like your community resource officer or public works to come, including your street, because all those city staff are going to be dedicated to the whack-a-mole of these moving homeless encampments instead of, you know, illegal dumpers in your neighborhood.
That's the voice of Brandon Harami. I'm going to bring back Nita B. Nita, as both you and Brandon were talking, you were demystifying or demythifying this notion of folks just coming from all over to reside in Oakland. A couple of things, and you tell me what you've seen because you've been on a tour, so you get to see it. I go to other parts of the Bay, and you don't see encampments like you do in Oakland. And I travel a lot. You see, there were large encampments in San Jose for a period, and probably still are. But you know, in other places, you don't see them. And the perception is that there is no homelessness. But what I found, if you go, for example, to places like in Santa Rosa, you might not see them in downtown to the degree that you may here in Oakland. But then when you go into the neighboring forest or parks, all of a sudden you see them, right? You see large encampments, you know, that stretch on for days. And so in many places, they've been able to be like, yeah, y'all, we know we got a homeless population, but we don't want you in sight. And so folks are off in the woods somewhere, but they're in large numbers. But can you talk a little bit about that? Because that also seems to be one of the things that's desirable. Like, I have empathy for the homelessness, but I don't want to see this woman who is throwing her clothes around, you know, in front of the farmer's market that I got to go to, you know, let her move somewhere else. And so what is the reality of that? As a region, what are all these different municipalities doing about resolving the homeless? Or is it really just out of sight, out of mind type of thing is the goal versus maybe making sure that people actually get housed?
Yeah, no, you hit it right on the dot. It is about, you know, NIMBYism has taken over people's, you know, attitudes, not in my backyard. And which is really, you know, kind of depressing, especially here in Oakland. Again, people love to like, you know, refer and look back to the vigor and the victories and the power of the civil rights and the Black Power movements. This being the home of the Panthers, people love to refer to the Panthers. Point four of their program is adequate housing for all, and that's something that has completely fell on its face. We've had you know, since 2020, that has not been a priority in Oakland to make sure that people have adequate, affordable housing. It's, you know, as we know, it's been about condos and beer gardens out here. And I think part of, you know, and then there's this another argument that they're saying is that, oh, you know, the rest of the country, the rest of the region is getting, you know, is cracking down on their homeless. So all these homeless folks are going to be, you know, flocking here to Oakland. And one of the reasons why we've seen, you know, such a large public, visible presence of homelessness in Oakland is because the city has never actually adequately addressed homelessness, or as their policies state, managed homelessness. The city has done a superb job on neglecting the unhoused population. And the two extremes that the city, you know, operates in is to either fully neglect the unhoused or to come after them and demolish their communities. And there is no in between. And what trips me out, like, Oakland has been a sanctuary for so many communities. You know, we can start with the wave of Black folks from the South during the Great Migration. In the 1930s and 40s, we can continue with the Indian Removal Acts, which literally dumped thousands of Native Americans in East Oakland, just left them there, took them from Oklahoma and brought them, took them from their lands across the country and brought them to Oakland. We can talk about the refugees of Southeast Asia through the 60s, the 70s, and 80s. I mean, it keeps on continuing. And it's so bizarre to me to see descendants of those various migrant movements now say, not here, we don't want you to come here looking for sanctuary. We don't, you know? And I have to think about, like, was that the same attitude that when it was mostly white folks who ran this when Oakland was still a white suburb of Frisco in the 1930s and 40s? Was that the attitude that those politicians had for all those black folks? Was that the same attitude that all those politicians had for the Native Americans who were being brought here? And so again, it's like, just like we see the Zionists who are attached to a community, a people, a religion that was targeted by the Nazis, they're becoming the oppressors who targeted the Jews of 1940s, 1930s Germany. And now we have the descendants of these different migratory movements who are sitting in these ivory towers, who are now targeting this new trend of migrants who may or may not, like we're saying, most of the folks from who are unhoused in Oakland are from here, from the neighborhoods. But if people are coming here looking for sanctuary because Oakland was one of the only cities that had a policy in place, it was not followed, but it was in place so that people could find sanctuary as unhoused right. people, who are we to turn them away?
Well, let me ask this to both of y'all. And that was Nita B, and we also have Brandon Harami. And let's keep it a buck, as they like to say. Why don't we see effective policies being put forth, not just from a city that is challenged economically, but by a region? Let's really talk about that, because, okay, I get it. You know, the folks that are here were displaced and they come back to their old stomping ground, so to speak. But developments and developers don't stop on the border of Oakland. They're in every city throughout Alameda County and beyond, right? Mm-hmm. And so maybe if I could find a cheap place in San Leandro, maybe I might just go there, but I can't. They're the same rents. Maybe if I go to Hayward, nope, it's the same rents, right? So we see that economic policies have made it, you know, very costly for you to find adequate housing anywhere. And if there was a city where rents were cheap, because one thing we know about Oakland, in spite of all her problems, rents are not cheap. They're some of the highest in the country, you know, which is something that we have to wrap our heads around. You know, from deep east to the lake to the hills, it's all unaffordable for a lot of folks. Mm-hmm. So the question comes to either one of you, why haven't we seen a convening of the minds in saying, look, this is an issue, you know, it's a statewide issue. Some cities bear the burden more than others, but here are some things. And in the past, we've had folks come on this show, through you, Nita, that have said, hey, you know, if we take some of these cargo containers that the ships have, we can build housing, right? I remember, you know, when you all were doing something over on MLK, and that mm-hmm. was a discussion we had with a guy named Ohio, I believe it was, or he was from
yep,
Ohio.
It was Ohio.
Right. And I remember him breaking that down. A few months later, after it was rejected here, we saw folks in Santa Rosa, you know, who after the fires took containers and made housing and they painted it. And these were folks who weren't traditionally homeless, but they were being lauded for being innovative, right? Mm-hmm. And they said, you can make housing out of this. Now you can go online and see housing being sold in the form of tiny houses made out mm-hmm. of containers. And there's mm-hmm. a city right now that is getting praised because they invested in tiny homes and made these really nice apartments and structures for houseless folks. And they're like, hey, here's the solution. So I'm sitting here wondering why we are in a region that has trillionaires and billionaire companies where a check could be written that could all just resolve these problems overnight. Why we mm-hmm. haven't seen a meeting of the minds and saying, here, we can get these situations done quick, fast, and in a hurry. And I'll close with saying, from what I saw with these containers, it didn't take a long time and a lot of red tape to get them up, because those folks that did it in Santa Rosa that painted them, they did that within a week. and you know, after the fires, and got all this national praise. So why haven't we seen that sort of thing in Oakland, and why aren't other cities or counties sharing in the burden of Oakland? Any one of y'all can take that. Maybe I'll start off with you, Brandon.
Yeah, sure. The container home thing is a great question. There's been a lot of talk of taking advantage of some more public land and putting kind of quick housing down, which is one thing you can do. I'm kind of skeptical of container home housing for various reasons. But on that same note, what Oakland has is a list of like half a dozen, if not longer, hotels, like older hotels that want to sell, anywhere from in the Laurel District to District 1, you know, here at like Temescal Rock Ridge, all the way to like Deep East Oakland. And these hotels would love to sell to the city. The city is about to get an influx of Measure W money that could potentially help the city buy more hotels. Hotels are one of the quickest way to get people off the street. And, you know, as much as having immediate shelter like a container home is nice, getting people dignified shelter, especially our elders, especially our families, stuff like that, we can do that in a very rapid way. What this policy, this encampment abatement policy, is doing is putting the cart before the horse. We should get this Measure W money. We should secure as many hotels and old apartments as possible.
What is Measure W?
It was a county measure that was held up in courts for a long time. And what it was, I believe, a parcel tax that funded homeless services. The county was still collecting the taxes while it was in court, and it has like $1 billion that it can spend on homeless intervention stuff. So the county right now is sitting on a big pot of money. Barbara Lee's ready to get it. Nikki Fortunato Bass, our supervisor, has been doing a really good job trying to make sure that Oakland gets it. And once this money comes in, we will be able to rapidly buy hotels that are available. There's a list that the city is sitting on that council members can have access to in their districts of hotels you want to sell. And if those council members want to be proactive, they should go find nonprofits. They should go to those hotels, and they should figure out how to get those nonprofits and those hotels to work together to create rapid housing. It is one of the quickest and most dignified ways. And the advantage over a container home is there's heat, there's water, there's your own bed. You oftentimes have your own bathroom. For our elders, for our families, for everyone, they deserve a dignified housing. And to your point, Mr. Davey, the general public, has to experience the fallout of this homeless crisis, right? They have to experience what it's like to have an encampment on their street. They have to experience what it's like to see someone, one of their neighbors, starving or in a mental health crisis. And the best way we can help those individuals and help the community is by getting those folks into dignified housing, not moving them around. So I'll finish at that and leave it to Nita.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And before I answer your question, Davey, I wanted to mention that the Measure W funds, first of all, they're not going to go directly to the city. The Board of Supervisors very specifically said that these funds will not be given to cities. And there's like either some denial or disconnect happening within our elected officials, because they really think this money is coming to the city of Oakland. And the Boards of Supervisors have repeatedly said, no, this is going directly to the service providers. And they're creating a whole standard of criteria for what service providers. A lot of the service providers here in Oakland have failed their constituents, their clients. I know BACS and, so there was an emergency round of funding from Measure W that went out about a month ago, and BACS, I believe, and BOSS, which are two very large nonprofits in Oakland that have been quote unquote managing shelters for unhoused people, were denied. The mayor did not, part of how Measure W was set up for that round of funding is that the mayor and the administrators of the cities that the nonprofits were on to operate on had to write a letter of recommendation. And the mayor declined to write a letter of recommendation to BACS and BOSS because they have fully failed, with no accountability for the millions of dollars that they received, and failed to fulfill properly managing and meeting all of the deliverables in their grants. And another thing that should be kept in mind is that the framework that Measure W money is being allocated for is not going to be supportive of cities that follow, that do not follow best practices, evidence-based best practices. And the direction the city of Oakland is going, the direction the city of Fremont has gone with criminalizing their unhoused population, is going to disqualify those cities from receiving any Measure W monies. And the way the policy, the proposal that Ken and Jenkins' office have been putting forward will also disqualify the city and the entire county of Alameda from state funding because of the way the state money allocations for homeless support and services is written. It's the same way that the Measure W framework is being written, that you have to follow best practices that are rooted in evidence-based approaches. What the evidence has shown is sweeps and tows cause the most harm to people, that not providing people with services is not the best practice, it is the worst practice. And so what you see is you have folks thinking they're going to get this money, but they won't. If they continue down this road, they will not get any. Oakland will not get Measure W funds, and Oakland will not get State of California funds.
But there's a wild card in the mix right now, and I know we're going to run out of time.
Mm-hmm.
But there are people listening to this, Brandon. There's people listening to this, Nita. That's like, you know, I saw that mayor in D.C. give a thumbs up. She's a sister to Donald Trump and what he did. And you know what? These tents are gone. Why don't we bring in the National Guard? And this is not far-fetched because there are people all up on these platforms that, you know, are advocating this. Now, they might not say it in public company, but they definitely have been clamoring it. And some people said it out loud, as we saw with the case with the head of Salesforce, right? I mean, he backtracked, but Trump has been holding on to that. And one thing we know is that once these folks show up, they don't leave. And right. So I think maybe folks are kind of counting on that. You know, like, look, you know, all this red tape, man, and deliverables, you know, and nonprofit. You know what? Just bring in the National Guard and have these folks disappear. Because at the end of the day, times is hard, and I'm tired of seeing these tents in my park. And that is an attitude that a lot of people have. It's a reality that we're going to have to deal with. I don't know if you can shame people into thinking another way, but that's where we're at. That's the lay of the land. And it seems like in some ways, maybe people who have the hands near the levers of power kind of want this chaos, because the end result will be, it's like, hey, we tried. Now we have to have the National Guard, and they'll just disappear it, and they won't follow no rules, and there's nothing we can do. That might be an end game for some of these folks. And we've seen some of them post up stuff that right. suggests that they're okay with that sort of heavy-handedness.
You know, if folks are okay with laws not being followed, with protections not being followed, and with people's rights being stripped, those same folks need to be ready for when that happens to them. Because that attitude and that kind of encouragement and advocacy is actually, it's a Pandora's box. Be careful what you ask for, because if you're totally fine with violating people's rights and with harming people and bringing in the National Guard, and like you said, when they come, they don't leave. None of the cities that the National Guard has come to, including Los Angeles, D.C., and that's been happening for a month and a half, 2 months now, that National Guard has not left. It is still a militarized, occupied zone. So it's very dangerous. I don't think people are being very reactionary. They want a quick fix solution. That doesn't exist. Yeah. That does not exist. And to address what you had asked, Davey, I think the reason why we don't see any solutions, and housing being the only solution to homelessness happening here in Oakland, in the Bay Area, in California, is because housing is not a right in this state. It is a commodity. And if you start building, they've built over 1,000 shelters, shelter beds in Oakland over the past 5 years. They've built maybe a couple hundred housing units that unhoused people can afford and keep. And the reason being is that if they start building to scale, the amount of deeply affordable housing that is needed to actually end homelessness, put a dent in it, that would drop the city, and if they do it in a regional way, the region's housing market. And the developers aren't having that. They want the housing market to continue to inflate. They want housing costs and rental costs to continue to rise. And if you build enough affordable housing to house the unhoused, then scales start to tip. We will see a drop. And that's what people need to understand. If they actually, there's so much victim blaming happening, right? People are mad at the unhoused people. Why are they not mad at the people who have been sitting and spending and misusing the billions of dollars that have come through Oakland, come through California? And that's what folks need to realize.
And keeping empty units.
Yes.
Hoarding empty units everywhere.
For folks who rent, it is in your best interest for you to advocate that the city immediately and permanently house unhoused people, because it'll bring down your rent.
Real talk. We're going to run out of time, so let me get some last comments from you, Brandon, and you know, and how people can get involved with anything.
Yeah, I want to appreciate having the opportunity to speak. And Nita, it's so great hearing your takes, because they're so on point. I think right now we as a city need to sit back and remember that these folks are our neighbors. These are people that live on their street. And to the point of you know, this desire for change and this desire for relief, we obviously see that. We see that with the recalls. We see that with this change in political discourse, where folks are feeling like overwhelmed, like they've been dealing with these problems for too long. That like a lot of people you'll talk to are like, I'm empathetic, but I am just so tired of not being able to go to the park without tents or without trash or whatever. And I feel like a lot of people are kind of turning to what they perceive as fast, quick solutions. When you're hungry, when you're really hungry and you're on a diet, it's pretty easy to break that diet and go get McDonald's, right? And same thing when you're an empathetic person and a kind person, but you're dealing with this problem that's been lasting for years and years and years and years and years, where you are dealing with the fallout of the homeless crisis, you know, there's temptation to go get that quick fix, that McDonald's, when in reality, you need salads. You need, you know, you can have McDonald's every once in a while, but you know, you need your salads and your good food. And we need to go back to a good diet of policy, right? Move away from the quick fast food policy and get back to the, if we want to see homelessness solved, if we want to end, you know, the mental health crisis on our street, we need to reinvest in quality public services for those who need them the most in California. And that's not just housing and mental health care. That's also Medicare for all. That's also universal child care. That's universal, you know, access to food. Because when we help those of us at sort of the bottom of our society financially, we support everyone. We lift from the bottom, right? We all know that you got to lift from the bottom when you lift something up. And as a society, we need to refocus on lifting from the bottom and refocus on rebuilding the politics of empathy that the Trump administration and this right-wing crazy politics has been destroying across our country, and including in Oakland.
Brandon Harami, we appreciate you taking time out. Nita B, two steps you're going to ask people to do. We have less than 30 seconds.
This Monday, City Council is going to have a special meeting to vote, to attempt to vote on this policy. We are asking folks to call your council member, email your council member, tell them to vote no, or to push this back in committee. That's something else that's been kind of a different trend. Usually policies that are very controversial or that still need to be workshopped or worked out are done so in committee, and they're held into committee until they're really flushed out. And that is not happening with this policy. So call your council member, email your council member, tell tell them vote no or put this back into life enrichment committee, the life enrichment committee. There, if you go to the Village in Oakland web page, Facebook page, there is a petition circulating. Please sign it. It is asking that the city not invest in criminalization of the poor, but invest in actual solutions of housing the unhoused. And that's all I got.
Well, we appreciate it, Nita B. Brandon Harami, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Ralph for now. Peace.
The rain falls hard. An old man sleeps, no roof, no guard. Under the freeway, lost in cold. Somebody's father left out alone. What mother could picture this sight? Her child forgotten, lost to the night. $1 billion homes lying the way, but for him there's no shelter, no place to stay. What happens to us when we fall from grace?
Fall from grace.
When the world turns its back. Why do the evil people never ever die? While the good ones suffer and ask the sky, is there no justice for the ones who cry? Will we ever rise? Will we ever thrive? As this old man shivers in the dead of night, rich people passing their lives. Full of light, they turn a blind eye, too busy to care, while he's left to freeze in the cold, cold air. Why do the evil people never ever die? While the good ones suffer and ask the sky, is there no justice for the ones who cry? Will we ever rise? Will we ever thrive?
Let the dialogue begin.
From the heart of the culture, where the beats do sway.
Hip hop, politics, and culture.
Ooh, the day.
Rock it on your radio.
Hard knock, rock it on your radio.
Hard knock, rock it on your radio.
Speaking truth to power.
Hard knock, rock it on your radio. Hard knock rocking on your radio.
Speaking truth to power.
Hard knock rocking on your radio. Hard knock rocking on
your radio.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Does your employer have a matching gifts program? Many companies offer dollar-for-dollar matching charitable contributions for donations you make to KBOO.